The Path of Compassion by G. de Perucker.
Page 43, Chapter 7. The Paramitas and the Exalted Eightfold Path. In Buddhist, as well as in modern theosophical literature, a great deal has been written about the glorious virtues, or paramitas. But unfortunately, they have been too often looked upon as being merely a noble but relatively unattainable code of conduct, which indeed they are. But they are more than this. They are actually the rules of thought and action which the would-be chela must follow, in the beginning as best he can, but later in completeness, so that his entire life becomes governed and enlightened by them. It is only thus that the disciple can reach what the Lord Buddha called the other shore, the spiritual realms which have to be reached by crossing the stormy ocean of human existence, and doing so under one's own spiritual and intellectual and psychical power, with only such help as can be given him in view of his own past karma. Footnote. Paramita and Paragata, or its equivalent, Paragamin, are Sanskrit compounds denoting one who has reached the other shore. Paramita, the feminine form, is used for the transcendental virtues or attributes which one must cultivate in order to reach that shore. There is a shade of difference in meaning to be noted here. Paramita carries the idea of having crossed over and therefore arrived, while Paragata, or Paragamin, implies departure from this end and thus gone in order safely to reach the other shore. Another word of frequent use in Buddhist writings, which also embodies both subtle distinctions of the above term, is Tathagata, a title given to Gautama Buddha. This is a Sanskrit compound that can be divided in two fashions. Tathagata, thus gone, that is, departed for and reached the other shore, and Tathagata, thus arrived or come, the significance of the term Tathagata being one who has both departed for and arrived at the other shore, as his predecessor Buddhas have done. End footnote. The idea of going to the other shore is commonly supposed to be typically oriental, but this seems unjustified, as many Christian hymns speak of the mystical Jordan and of reaching the shore beyond, a conception which appears to be more or less identical with that of Buddhism. This side is the life of the world, the usual or common pursuits of men. The other shore is simply the life spiritual, involving the expansion in relatively full power and function of the entire range of man's nature. In other words, to reach the other shore means living at one with the divinity within, and hence partaking of the universal life in relatively full self-consciousness. The teaching of all the great religious and philosophical systems has been to urge upon their followers the fact that our real goal is to learn the lessons of manifested existence and to graduate from this experience into the cosmic life. As the Dhammapada, verse 85, has it, quoting, "There are few people who reach the other shore. The others run wild on this shore." End quotation. A short Buddhist writing called the Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra, or the heart or essence of the wisdom of the passing over, closes with a beautiful mantra which runs as follows in the original Sanskrit. Quoting, "Gate, gate, para gate, para sam gate, bodhi svaha. O wisdom, gone, gone, gone to the other shore, landed on the other shore, hail." End quotation. Wisdom in this context may be taken as referring to the cosmic buddhi, otherwise called adi buddhi, or primeval wisdom, and also, in an individualized sense, to the supreme silent watcher of our planetary chain, Adi Buddha, The one addressed is he who has arrived at the other shore, the triumphant pilgrim, who has become self-consciously at one with the God within him, and thus has successfully perceived through the maya or illusions of the phenomenal worlds. The highest ones who have attained this are Jivan Muktas, freed monads. Those less high belong to the different grades in the several hierarchies of the hierarchy of compassion. The discipline of the paramitas, as HPB gave them in the Voice of the Silence, pages 47 and 8, is as follows, quoting, Dana, the key of charity and love immortal. Shila, the key of harmony in word and act, the key that counterbalances the cause and the effect and leaves no further room for karmic action. Kshanti, patience sweet that naught can ruffle. Viraga, indifference to pleasure and to pain, illusion conquered, truth alone perceived. Virya, the dauntless energy that fights its way to the supernal truth out of the mire of lies terrestrial. Dhyana, whose golden gate, once opened, leads the Narjol or Nuljor toward the realm of Sat Eternal and its ceaseless contemplation. Prajna, the key to which makes of a man a god, creating him a bodhisattva, son of the Jnanis. End quotation. The manner in which these paramitas are to be practiced is well illustrated by the following extract from the Mahayana Shraddhotpada Shastra, which, however, mentions only 6, although they are given elsewhere as 7, and when more fully enumerated as 10. Footnote. The Mahayana Shraddhotpada Shastra is often translated as the awakening of faith in the Mahayana, but this very inadequately conveys the significance of the original Sanskrit. Shraddha means certainty or confidence based on an unfoldment of inner experiences, the proof of which lies both within and without the self, and implying here a continued process of inner unfoldment, a connotation which is utterly lacking in the word faith. As to utpada, this carries the same idea of continuance and progressive unfoldment, an awakening or rising towards an awareness or realization of wisdom, culminating in the mystic renunciation of the fruits of emancipation and the attainment of Buddhahood. This scripture belongs to the Prajna Paramita family of writings and is usually credited to Ashvaghosha, a notable Buddhist scholar who lived during the latter half of the 1st century A.D. and whose outstanding work is the Mahalamkara, or Book of Great Glory, end footnote. Quoting from the Mahayana Shraddhotpada Shastra, how should one practice charity, dana? If someone comes and asks for anything, disciples, as far as they are able, should grant the request ungrudgingly and in a way to benefit them. If disciples see anyone in danger, they should try every means they have to rescue him and impart to him a feeling of safety. If anyone comes to disciples desiring instruction in the Dharma, they should, as far as they are able, and according to their best judgment, try to enlighten him. And when they are doing these acts of charity, they should not cherish any desire for recompense, or gratitude, or merit, or advantage, nor any worldly reward. They should seek to concentrate the mind on those universal benefits and blessings that are for all alike, and by so doing will realize within themselves highest perfect wisdom. How should one practice virtuous precepts, shila? Lay disciples, having families, should abstain from killing, stealing, adultery, lying, duplicity, slander, frivolous talk, covetousness, malice, currying favor, and false doctrines. Unmarried disciples should, in order to avoid hindrances, retire from the turmoil of worldly life, and, abiding in solitude, should practice those ways which lead to quietness and moderation and contentment. They should endeavor by their conduct to avoid all disapproval and blame, and by their example incite others to forsake evil and practice the good. How should one practice patience forbearance, kshanti? As one meets with the ills of life, he should not shun them nor feel aggrieved. Patiently bearing evils inflicted by others, he should cherish no resentment. He should neither be elated because of prosperity, praise, or agreeable circumstances, nor depressed because of poverty, insult, or hardship. Keeping his mind concentrated on the deep significance of the Dharma, he should, under all circumstances, maintain a quiet and equitable mind. How should one practice courageous vigor, virya? In the practice of good deeds, one should never become indolent. He should look upon any mental or physical suffering as the natural following of unworthy deeds done in previous incarnations, and should firmly resolve that henceforth he would only do those things which are in keeping with a spiritual life. Cherishing compassion for all beings, he should never let the thought of indolence arise, but should ever be indefatigably zealous to benefit all beings. How should one practice meditation, dhyana? Intellectual insight is gained by truthfully understanding that all things follow the law of causation, but in themselves are transitory and empty of any self-substance. There are two aspects of dhyana. The first aspect is an effort to suppress idle thinking. The second is a mental concentration in an effort to realize this emptiness, shunyata, of mind essence. At first, a beginner will have to practice these separately, but as he gains mind control, the two will merge into one. He should contemplate the fact that although all things are transitory and empty, yet nevertheless, on the physical plane, they have a relative value to those who are cherishing false imagination. To these ignorant ones, suffering is very real. It always has been, and it always will be, immeasurable and innumerable sufferings. Because of all this, there is awakened in the mind of every earnest disciple a deep compassion for the suffering of all beings that prompts him to dauntless, earnest zeal and the making of great vows. He resolves to give all he has and all he is to the emancipation of all beings. After these vows, the sincere disciple should at all times, and as far as his strength and mind permit, practice those deeds which are beneficial alike to others and to himself. Whether moving, standing, sitting, or lying, he should assiduously concentrate his mind on what should be wisely done and wisely left undone. This is the active aspect of jhana. How can one practice intuitive wisdom, prajna? When one by the faithful practice of dhyana attains to samadhi, he has passed beyond discrimination and knowledge. He has realized the perfect oneness of mind essence. With this realization comes an intuitive understanding of the nature of the universe. He now realizes the perfect oneness of essence, potentiality, and activity in Tathagatahood. Prajna Paramita is highest perfect wisdom. Its fruitage comes unseen, without effort, spontaneously. It merges all seeming differences, whether they be evil or good, into one perfect whole. Therefore, let all disciples who aspire after highest perfect wisdom, which is Prajna Paramita, assiduously apply themselves to the discipline of the noble path, for that alone will lead them to perfect realization of Buddhahood. End quotation. In order to understand and spiritually to feel the true nature of prajna, it is necessary to abandon this side view, and in spiritual comprehension to go over to the other shore, para, or other manner of looking at things. On this side we are involved in a sphere of consciousness of brain-mind analyses and particulars, which becomes a world of attachments and lower plane distinctions. When we achieve this inner reversal, this shifting of our consciousness upwards to the mystic other shore of being, we then enter more or less successfully into a world of transcendent realities, from which we can view things in their original and spiritual oneness, beyond the maya of the deceptive veils of multiplicity, penetrate into the essential nature of these realities, and cognize them as they truly are. This condition of inner clarity and of accurate spiritual and intellectual apperception is so different from the familiar operations of our this-side consciousness in our everyday world of transitory appearances that untrained minds associate it with the conception of emptiness, vacuity. Emptiness, shunyata, to use the Buddhist term, in its true metaphysical meaning, however, should not be confounded with nothingness, implying an absolute negation of real being, and thus annihilation. Nor is it to be understood through the ratiocinative faculties of the brain-mind, but rather by the direct or immediate perception belonging to the high spiritual intellectual state called prajna, which is above the mayavi distinctions of being and non-being, of particular and universal, of the many and the one. Indeed, this high state is the intuitive knowledge and penetrating insight of the spirit mind in man, his buddhi manas, which is immeasurably more powerful and penetrating than his mere intellection. Such intuitive knowledge and insight lie ever active in the loftiest and most universal recesses of our consciousness. It is through the gradual awakening of the lower man into self-conscious realization of this spiritual intellectual consciousness, which in its active manifestations is identical with prajna, that we arise from the lower realms of our consciousness and escape from the bondage of ignorance and nescience, avidya, and thus become liberated from the various kinds of both inner and outer pain. This release is the attainment of supreme enlightenment and of emancipation, mukti. In brief, prajna may perhaps best be translated as intuition, signifying that instant illumination or full knowledge which verily is godlike. In the prajna paramita group of Buddhist scriptures, prajna is regarded as the directing principle of the other paramitas, pointing to them as being the method of reaching reality. It is compared to the perceiving and understanding eye that surveys with perfect clearness of vision the horizons of life, and designates the path to be followed by the aspirant. Without prajna, the other paramitas would be devoid of one of their highest elements. It guides their progressive development somewhat as the earth provides the fields of sustenance for the growth of vegetation. All beings in the universe possess prajna, although it is not functioning self-consciously, except when the evolving entities in the course of their evolutionary pilgrimage have become at one with it. The animals have prajna, including bees and ants as instances, but any self-conscious awareness thereof is lacking, because such self-realization of union with prajna begins only with man, at least on this earth, in its first feeble workings, prajna in the human being, manifests as aspiration towards illumination, love, and wisdom, blossoms in the bodhisattva, and is in full bloom in the Buddhas and Christs, which is the state of perfect enlightenment. The high chela, or initiate, who has successfully reached the stage where he has become the paramitas, with his consciousness crystal clear and relatively boundless, his whole being attuned to the spiritual soul of humanity, having given up his self to the selfless glory of living for all that is technically called a bodhisattva, one whose essence, sattva, is of the very nature of wisdom, bodhi. The motive which prompts the true disciple to realize within himself supreme enlightenment is never personal gain, however exalted and spiritualized, but the urge to benefit the whole world, to raise all beings from the chains of ignorance and pain, to arouse within himself a compassionate heart for all that lives, so that every sentient being may in time attain to perfect emancipation. Footnote. See Fo Mu, Prajna Paramita, Fascicle 14, Chapter on Wise Men. End footnote. In the Maha Prajna Paramita, the question is asked of Shariputra whether the bodhisattva should pay respect only to other bodhisattvas and not to all beings generally, to which the sage answers that he should, in fact, revere them with the same feeling of self-abnegation as he does the Tathagatas. He then goes on to say, in Xuan Chuang, Fascicle 387, Chapter 12, on Morality, quoting, "The bodhisattva should thus awaken a great compassionate feeling towards all beings and keep his mind completely free from arrogance and self-conceit. And let him feel in this wise, I will practice all the skillful means in order to make all sentient beings realize that which is the foremost in themselves, in other words, their Buddha nature, Buddhata. By realizing this, they all become Buddhas." End quotation. Prajna in the individual entity, such as a human being, holds pretty much the same position that Adi Buddhi or Maha Buddhi does in the universe. One of the axioms of the esoteric wisdom is that our universe is an entity. Hence we configurate its individual universal mind or consciousness as a vast ocean of self-conscious Buddhi monistic energy points. From this standpoint, prajna may be described as the spiritual individual consciousness of every member of the hosts of Jnani Chohans or cosmic spirits. Thus, when one has attained prajna awareness, he is in self-conscious communion with the Buddhi monistic mind of the wondrous being of our hierarchy. From the foregoing, it should be clear that there are numerous differences in grandeur of accomplishment as among the members of a hierarchy. For there are differences in grades of attainment between the chela, beginning the path, and a mahatma, followed by still higher beings, having an even larger realization of prajna on the ladder of achievement that extends steadily upwards until the wondrous being is reached. The prajna is the same in all. The differences among individuals lie in their respective manifestation of it. There are also differences of another kind, such as that between one who has attained a relative realization of prajna and who enters nirvana, and another of similar attainment but who renounces nirvana. Here we have an important distinction based on cosmic ethics. The one who has won nirvana yet renounces it in order to turn back and help the world stands far higher ethically than does the one who enters nirvana for his own bliss. Each has reached a sufficiency of at-one-ment with prajna to have gained the nirvanic state. but the one who renounces it has achieved a self-conscious realization of prajna on a higher buddhic plane than the one who won nirvana and enters into it. The key to this mystery lies in the fact that every one of the seven principles in the human constitution is septenary, and hence buddhi, which is the seat of prajna, is sevenfold. We thus see that the one entering nirvana has reached what we may define as kama buddhi, but has gone no higher in the quality of his realization of prajna, whereas the other one, who renounced nirvana, has attained that condition of buddhic prajna, which we may describe as either buddhi buddhi or manas buddhi. The Buddhas and Mahabuddhas are those who hold what we may call the atmic state of buddhi, and thus feel themselves absolutely and unqualifiedly self-identified with the universe. The seven paramitas, as given, contain the gist of the code of conduct embodied in the fuller enumeration of 10 paramitas, or the complete ethical decalogue of occultism. The three additional paramitas are adhisthana, upeksha, and prabodha, or sambuddhi. Of these, adhisthana, meaning inflexible courage, not merely awaits danger or difficulty, but when enlightened by intuition or prajna, goes forwards and stands up to it. Its natural place follows virya, or fortitude. The next, upeksha, or discrimination, searches for and finds the right method of applying the paramitas, and appropriately comes after dhyana. Two terms are given for the 10th paramita: prabodha, meaning awakenment of the inner consciousness, bringing knowledge and foreknowledge, thus opening up glorious visions on the pathway, and sambuddhi, complete or perfect illumination or vision or self-consciousness of one's identity with the spiritual, the culmination or crown of all. Otherwise phrased, it is union with buddhi. Other virtues are occasionally included by other schools of esoteric or quasi-occult training in the Orient, as examples, satya or truth, and maitra or universal friendliness or benevolence. But when analyzed, these are seen to be already embodied in the 10 paramitas. Also, it may be mentioned here that in many parts of the world there are various systems of training, most of them futile, for on careful examination they will be found to be more or less modifications of Hatha Yoga, and as pointed out, these are extremely dangerous, even at the best, and at the worst will produce insanity or loss of the soul. Strength is born from exercise, and it is the exercising of our strength in the tests and experiences of daily life that in time leads to the treading of the path. Unless the student follow the inner discipline, which is the continuous and never-failing practice of the spirit of these 10 glorious virtues or paramitas as his inflexible rule of thought and of action from day to day, he will never succeed in his endeavors. It is just this discipline, this exercising of his willpower and of his intelligence and of the love which should fill his heart, which eventually bring the neophyte to the new or second birth, which produce the dvija, the twice-born, the initiate, finally to become the master of life and of death. The reader may be wondering just what connection the paramitas have to do with the much more familiar teachings of Buddhism known respectively as the Four Noble Truths and their logical corollary, the Eightfold Path. The connection is both historical and intimate, for both contain the same root ideas, only in the more popular teaching so phrased as to furnish a code of conduct which the average worldly man is capable of following, if he desire to avoid the harassing mistakes attendant upon human life, and to attain the peace and intellectual detachment which accompany a life well and nobly lived. Briefly, the four high truths are, first, that the cause of the suffering and heartache in our lives arises from attachment or thirst, trishna. Second, that this cause can be made to cease. Third, that the cessation of the causes productive of human sorrow is brought about by living the life which will free the soul from its attachment to existence. And the fourth truth, leading to the extinction of the causes of suffering, is verily the exalted eightfold path, to wit, right belief, right resolve, right speech, right behavior, right occupation, right effort, right contemplation, right concentration. Now this course of endeavor was called by the Buddha the middle way, because it involved no useless or fanatical asceticism on the one hand, and no laxity of principle and of thought and consequent behavior on the other hand. It is a code, as said, that is within the reach of every man or woman, calling for no special conditions or circumstances, but able to be practiced by anyone who yearns to better his life and to do his part in helping to bring about the surcease of the world misery surrounding us, and of which sensitive human hearts everywhere are conscious. It must not be supposed, however, that the chela neglects the ethical injunctions of the Eightfold Path, for this would be a misapprehension of their import. In fact, he not only practices them, but does so with far greater concentration of mind and heart than the average man, because at the same time he is striving with all his soul to raise himself to the sublime altitude of the paramitas by which he should live. It is perhaps necessary to weigh somewhat strongly upon this point, because there is a totally erroneous idea current among some half-baked mystics that it is a part of the chela's life to ignore normal human relations, to take small account of them, and to imagine that he is freed from his duties, even of a worldly kind, towards his fellow men. This last supposition runs directly counter to all the teaching of occultism. The principle behind the four high truths and their eight corollaries is this: if the root of attachment, desire, can be cut, the soul thereupon becomes freed, and in thus liberating itself from the chains of desire which bring about attachment, the cause of sorrow is made to cease. And the way of cutting the root of attachment is by so living that gradually the thirst of the soul for the things of matter dies. When this happens, the individual is free. He has become a relatively perfected jivan mukta, a master of life. Once he has reached this stage of utter detachment, he is a bodhisattva, and thereafter devotes himself completely to all beings and things, his heart filled with infinite compassion, and his mind illuminated with the light of eternity. Thus it is that as a bodhisattva he appears again and again on earth, either as a Buddha or as a bodhisattva, or indeed remains in the invisible worlds as a nirmanakaya. The common idea regarding the bodhisattva, that he has only one more incarnation to undergo before he becomes a Buddha, is correct as far as it goes, but as thus expressed is inadequate. As a matter of fact, the ideal both of esoteric theosophy and esoteric Buddhism is the bodhisattva, even more perhaps than the Buddha, for the reason that the bodhisattva is one whose whole being and objective, whose whole work, is the doing of good unto all beings, and the bringing of them safely to the other shore. Whereas the Buddha, while the same thing and in an extended degree, nevertheless by the very fact of his Buddhahood, in the present stage of spiritual unfoldment of the human race, is on the threshold of nirvana and usually enters therein. It is, of course, quite possible for a Buddha to refuse the nirvana and to remain on earth as a bodhisattva or a nirmanakaya. And in this last case, as a Buddha of compassion, he is at once a Buddha by right and a bodhisattva by choice. Too much stress cannot be laid upon the great need of understanding the inner significance of the bodhisattva doctrine, embodying as it does the spirit of occult teaching running throughout the cycle of initiatory training, as well as in the nobler schools of the Mahayana. It is at once seen why, in northern Buddhism, the bodhisattva is so greatly honored and occupies so lofty a position in the reverence of human hearts. For the Buddhas of compassion are such because they themselves embody this ideal when they renounce the spiritually selfish bliss of nirvanic Buddhahood in order to remain in the world, to work for it. Even the humblest and least educated can aspire towards this ideal. In future eons, one must choose whether he will become one of the Buddhas of compassion or one of the Pratyeka Buddhas. When the choice comes, it will come as the karmic resultant of lives previously lived, for it results from the bent of one's character, the spiritual faculties aroused, the will made to be alert, responsive to command. All these will govern and, in fact, make the choice when the time for choosing arrives. Therefore, the training starts now. Becoming great in small things, one learns to become great in great things. As a final thought, one must not be heavy in living the life which the High Eightfold Path, or indeed the Paramitas, enjoin. He should joy in so doing. For I sincerely believe that everyone who practices these noble rules, to some extent at least, will be enormously bettered by them. Nor can we be oblivious of how greatly such consistent practice will increase the willpower, strengthen the mind, enlarge the sympathies of the heart, and bring about a glorious illumination of soul, all of which in their final stages produce the Mahatma, the true Bodhisattva.